Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen, and joining me in studio right now from Michigan Tech is Dr. Nancy Langston. She has a book out, Sustaining Lake Superior. You may have been able to catch her as she's been talking in the community about topics that are covered in her book, and so that's what we're going to talk about today. Nancy, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be back.
It's always a good and informative interview when you and I get a chance to sit down, and you know, the book's title, Sustaining Lake Superior. And you mentioned something a moment ago that struck me, that, you know, you said your publisher said it was a small topic, and it's such a big lake, and it is not a small topic.
Yes, it's been really intriguing. People who don't live in the Great Lakes Basin think, oh, the Great Lakes, why do they matter? Why does Lake Superior matter? It's just one lake. And I tell them, of course, it's the biggest lake in the world. And we're at the head of a basin that contains 21% of the world's fresh water. And fresh water, clean water, is going to be more important in the future than oil or almost anything else we can think about. So what we do here to Lake Superior will really shape the future, not just of the Great Lakes, but of the entire world.
Now, when I lived downstate, I was, you know, no stranger to the Great Lakes. I saw Lake Erie and Lake Huron and Lake Michigan quite often, actually. But there was nothing compared to the majesty that I experienced when I came up north and finally got to the northern coastline of the Upper Peninsula, and there was Lake Superior. And I mean, the water's blue just like the rest of the Great Lakes, and you know, you can't see across the to the other side just like the rest of the Great Lakes, but there was something different about it. It was like being on the side of an ocean, and you can tell that, you know, it stands alone in the world for what it is.
Absolutely. Early explorers from Europe used to call this the Sweetwater Sea when they first came. They couldn't believe that it wasn't salt water because it's so enormous. And as we saw in the huge storms this week, that the waves can top 25 to 30 feet. It really is like an ocean.
A lot of studies are done on Lake Superior. Why did it interest you to write a book on it?
Well, like so many other people, when I first came to the shores of Lake Superior, I was literally blown away. The winds were really strong, and I had actually trouble standing. And I had lived in the Pacific Northwest for years, and I had fallen in love with the ocean and with the riparian borders between land and water in the West. And so when I moved to the Midwest 22 years ago, I really loved it. It was very beautiful. I lived in downstate Wisconsin. But it was when I came to Lake Superior, first time 15 years ago, that I realized I had really been missing something, and that was that sense of vastness and power and just the extraordinary majesty of nature right here in the Midwest.
Has the reverence for Lake Superior existed ever since, you know, we started settling in this area?
Absolutely. When the Ojibwe and first came to the shores of Lake Superior and the other Great Lakes thousands of years ago, they came because of visions, because of a set of dreams about Manuman, the rice that grows on water, the food that grows on water. And when they reached the shores of Lake Superior, their stories recall that they also felt this extraordinary spiritual power of the lake, that they had found their true home. And I think that sense of majesty, of power, of real value has been true for people no matter what culture they come from when they reach the shores of this great lake.
Now, it's so big, you think that, you know, something that big is invulnerable, that there's nothing you can do to hurt it. It's just so much, and, you know, you can't drain it. You can't take any number of buckets out of Lake Superior in order to make it go down. You can't affect it. Anything, we've seen in history, anything you dump on it just disappears because you don't see it anymore, at least until you start dumping a lot. So that sort of opinion has... We had to learn that over time and by making a number of mistakes early on.
Exactly. Lake Superior is roughly the size of Maine. And when you think of dropping a drop of poison on top of Maine, you think, what harm can it possibly do? And people had to learn slowly, but they certainly learned that dilution is not always the solution to pollution. For certain kinds of pollution, that works great. So say when a deer, you know, goes to the bathroom on the shores of a creek, then the dilution and the assimilative capacity, it's called, the oxygen that gets into the water, can break down the bacteria in that feces, and soon the water is clean again. And so early people who were trying to develop industries around Lake Superior, the paper industry, the mining industry, the fishing industry, recognized that it wasn't a good thing to dump pollution into their drinking water. They weren't stupid by any means. So they had to figure out how much pollution that natural processes could actually break down. And this worked pretty well in the initial years. We managed to have a paper industry, a mining industry that created some local pollution, but didn't really kill people and didn't destroy the fisheries and the other wildlife resources. But after World War II, when we started developing new synthetic contaminants that could travel very long distances, that was when people began to realize that we had to be much more careful about pollution because it could bioaccumulate or get more and more and more concentrated as it worked up the food chain.
So did the early years of mining, when I say early years, I would say, you know, anywhere from the, you know, like 1870 on through 1920, 1930, were we doing a lot of damage?
Well, there was a lot of mining starting in the 1840s, so the treaties that were signed with the tribes here were to enable mining. And so it did some cultural damage, certainly. There was real pressure to push people off their lands. And there was some local harm done to rivers and streams in the area. So, for example, when the copper mining industry began on the Keweenaw Peninsula, it really relied on the water in streams. But it also used a lot of those streams as a place to dump tailings, you know, the waste products from mining. So pretty quickly, the mining processing itself had to shift because they'd used up all the water nearby. There was really no place left for them to operate. So then they began to shift their operations to the shores. And now we see some of the effects at, say, the Gay Stamp Sands. So there were some toxics, but they weren't doing widespread harm. They were fairly local, and you could move away from them. But later, those stamp sands became more toxic when we began re-dredging them. So the initial mining didn't manage to get all the copper out. And when copper prices increased, then they used more synthetic chemicals to try and extract the remaining valuable copper. They also used a lot of PCBs and the processing materials. So they weren't using PCBs to mine, but in the big industrial smelters and in the processing plants, the stamp mills, there were PCBs. And those, it turns out, break down very, very slowly. So we're still having to deal with the remnants of that industrial processing.
When we see the effects that the mine tailings had in Lake Torch Lake and the fish and everything that comes, you know, the whole Superfund site there, any of that that was seen in Lake Superior at all?
Yes, absolutely. In the book, I spend a couple chapters talking about something called the reserve mining controversy. And this was over on the north shore of Minnesota, where just like around here, there had been iron mining. We had iron mining in Marquette, and there was also very intense iron mining over on the shores of Minnesota and up what's now called the Iron Range. It was the world's largest iron mining district. It was called the Lake Superior District. And it produced the iron that was made into steel in the lower Great Lakes and actually allowed us to win two world wars. It was really essential in fighting wars. But by the end of World War II, that high-grade iron was beginning to be depleted. It was getting harder and harder to find it economically. And everyone, the miners, the legislators, the Congress people, such as Congressman Blatnick, were really worried about what would happen to the region if those big iron mines shut down. They were afraid it would become like Appalachia, a place of real economic poverty and devastation. And everyone knew that there was a very low-grade kind of iron called taconite. It was mostly a waste product. It was really hard iron in really hard ore bodies, so really difficult to get to. And with the help of the federal government and the state government, the mining companies developed a new process to actually be able to use that low-grade iron ore taconite. And that saved the Iron Range. It saved the communities on the Iron Range. But the problem with it was that since it was so high in waste products, you had to figure out what to do with the tailings. And they were vast quantities. And so right after World War II in 1947, Minnesota really struggled with that question. The company, Reserve Mining Company, thought the best solution was to dump the tailings right into Lake Superior. They thought, the lake's so big. These are just natural materials. It'll be fine. But the rest of the region got involved because Wisconsin said, whoa, wait a minute, this is our lake too. And Canada said, excuse me, we signed a treaty. No one country can pollute these boundary waters. They belong to all of us. And so Minnesota took this really seriously. They had 9 public hearings around the region. They came over to the Keweenaw to look at our copper stamp sands to see if they were causing problems with the fishing community. They invited testimony from literally thousands of people. There were about 10,000 pages of documents that I worked through in the archives over in St. Paul. As the state tried to decide what was more important, fostering a mining industry to replace the one that was dwindling away, are protecting public waters for the fishing and for the common good of the region. And what they decided was that Lake Superior was big enough that surely it would be a good place to store the tailings. And very quickly, within a year, fishermen began complaining that their nets were being fouled by what they called slime, this green slime that was putrid, and they weren't catching fish, they were just catching slime. And so the state listened to them, but it also listened to the miners who really wanted jobs. And what they were afraid of, both the miners and the legislators, was that if they shut down the dumping in Lake Superior, the industry would have to use inland lakes to dump their waste. And they would simply fill up lake after lake after lake, and nobody wanted that. And so they decided essentially to ignore the fishermen and the tribal communities as well, because a lot of tribal members were participating in commercial fishing. So this wasn't a case of jobs versus the environment. It was two different economic futures that were both really important for the state. And everyone agreed they wanted clean water and clean lakes, but they also wanted good jobs. So they continued with the dumping, and very quickly, by 1956, 1957, they realized that the tailings were moving throughout the entire western arm of the lake. They were making it to Wisconsin. They were making it down to Duluth. They were contaminating fishing grounds and spawning sites. And yet this push for more jobs continued. And it wasn't until two women, one Verna Mize, who had a summer home here on the Keweenaw, had grown up here, and then Arlene Leto, a Finnish woman up on the North Shore, that they started talking to scientists, and they recognized that there was actually asbestos, a kind of form of asbestos, in the tailings that were getting into the lake, and it was moving through the western third of the lake. So they went and started bringing together a lot of grassroots citizens to say, we don't want asbestos in our drinking water. And somebody checked the drinking water of Duluth, the biggest city on the lake, and realized in some of the water samples there were more than 1 billion fibers of asbestos in a quart of drinking water. So that was what finally turned the tide. And citizens began speaking up to scientists and saying, we really, really need to protect clean water more than we need to protect a mining industry. So it was the first big court case for the brand new Environmental Protection Agency. And eventually the company agreed to a settlement that said that they would create an inland place for their tailings. And the company has changed hands, but the mine still operates and still supports a lot of jobs in the region, but the water is a lot cleaner.
And what time was that? What year?
So 1947 was when they decided on the permits. It took 9 years to build this big facility because it was enormous. So 1956 was when they started releasing the tailings into the lake. 1957 was when fishermen started getting worried, and there were more and more and more expressions of concern. But it wasn't until 1972 that we had a new Environmental Protection Agency and a new water quality lab in Duluth. And they started listening to these women who were beginning to say, we don't want asbestos in our drinking water. So it was 1972 when the federal government finally said, look, we have to have clean water.
So we're 45 years past that time where that was realized and a stop was put to it. Does the lake face any similar threats today?
Yes, absolutely. And one thing I want to talk about is it's easy to hear about pollution in the lakes and what the mining industry sometimes did and think, oh, this is all a depressing story. But one of the main stories I found in this book is that Lake Superior has an amazing conservation recovery. At the end of the 19th century, right after the first mining boom in copper, the logging industry came in. They logged much of Maine, Weyerhaeuser Company, and then they thought the forests around the Great Lakes, especially Lake Superior, were so huge, we could never cut them down. They had two men cross-cut saws. They didn't have chainsaws. And they thought, you know, with mules and oxen and cross-cut handheld saws, you could never make a dent in the trees. And within 23 years, the white pine was pretty much gone. And then the hemlock and then all the secondary species. People tried farming. They were promised if this watershed could grow trees, it could grow great potatoes and great farms. That worked in some places, but mostly it didn't work very well. So there was real poverty by the end of the 19th century. And citizens and government, state governments and the federal government came together to really try and restore forests and fisheries. And it was a huge success. We're almost 90% forested now. And we lost not all of our trees at the end of the 19th century, but we lost an enormous percentage, up to 90% of our white pines. And we lost the wildlife that depended on those forests. And that's come back. So one of the most inspiring stories I found is that if we work at it, we really can bring these communities back, both the ecological communities and the human communities that depend on them. So in answer to your question, sure, we face new challenges. There's still mercury. There's a lot of mercury in the lake that gets into the fish, that gets into people that eat the fish. And that mercury is coming a little bit from our local mining industry, but it's mostly coming from coal burning down in the lower Great Lakes and in Asia. But we know what the answer to that is. The answer is to switch from coal to something that doesn't poison us quite as much. We have the technology to do it. We have the political will. We just need to make it happen. So I think the big message of this book is that there's cause for hope. Communities came together in the past to overcome much bigger challenges. So we can do it again.
Coal burning in Asia affecting Lake Superior?
Yes. So a lot of pollutants move throughout the globe by something called the grasshopper effect. So they go up in the air, and then when it rains, they come down in the rain. And then when it gets warm again, they get released and go back up in the air, and they bounce their way like little grasshoppers all the way north until they reach a really cold lake, and then they can't bounce their way north again. So essentially, Lake Superior has become a big sink for many of the world's pollutants. We have much higher levels of mercury than you might expect because it gets captured in the water. We have very high levels of toxaphene, a cotton herbicide. We don't grow a lot of cotton around here, but we have some of the world's highest levels of this cotton herbicide. And that's because every time you plow an old cotton field, those old poisons get released and end up in our lake. And we have a lot of other pollutants, old DDT, that we didn't use very much around the lake, but the rest of the world's DDT has come to our lake. So one of our big challenges is local actions are really important, but we're not burning all the coal that's affecting our children, yet we have to figure out how to deal with it. And that has to happen through global action, not just through local actions.
Now, the changes that we've had and seen in the globe and climate, how is that affecting the conditions of Lake Superior, in a sense, of course, you know, our area around here?
Great question. We are actually the fastest warming large lake in the world. And that surprises a lot of people because it doesn't seem that hot around here. We still have winter snows. But we've also noticed that there's a trend towards much warmer fall temperatures. And any one day that's really hot or any one big storm, we don't know that that's climate change. There's always natural variability. So you have to look at trends over time. And we're seeing some very significant trends in the Lake Superior region. We have actually seen increased air temperatures of 1 degree Fahrenheit per decade in the last six decades. And again, that may not sound like that much because we see bigger variations between day and night. But when you look at what it means for our plant communities, our fish communities, it actually becomes really important. One way to think about it is, by the end of my lifetime, so that's, you know, say 5 decades from now, the climate here in the summer could be like the climate of Oklahoma summers. So we're seeing migrating climates, and it's hard for me to imagine that cool, mild summers could become like Oklahoma summers. And our water temperatures are warming even faster. They're warming at twice the rate of air temperatures. So that means 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade warming. And in July, our summer surface temperatures are even warmer. They are up to 15 degrees warmer in July than normal already. So those are pretty profound changes that are having big effects potentially on fisheries.
Well, I apologize for the banging. They're actually redoing the roof here. So as long as they don't fall on us, I think we're okay. But somebody may come with, you know, sort of a flippant response and say, hey, great, warmer lake. We can build more condos. We can, I don't have to use my snowblower so much. If we were ever to get to the point that it's a good thing that things are a lot warmer, there's a lot that would have to be destroyed to get there. If you're talking about species of, wildlife, trees, fish, all of those things that would be affected, through the warming, and they say, oh, well, okay, it would be great to have a nice warm summer like Oklahoma if that's what you want. I don't. I moved this far north for that. But think about destroying everything that's already here in order to get, that nice warm lake. And then, of course, if you go south of here, the damage that's there.
Yeah, it would be dramatic changes. And in some ways, people in the Lake Superior Basin would do better than people in a lot of other places across the world, because we would still have a climate where you can grow things, where it's not too hot to go outside in the middle of the day. My brother and his family live in Phoenix now, and it's already becoming really too hot for them to go outside during the day. They can't even swim in the community pool in the summer because it's like swimming in a hot tub. And so there are concerns that places like Phoenix could actually become really, really difficult for people to continue to live. And that's not going to happen to Lake Superior. But we become who we are. We have cultures of the North that are formed through our relationships with our fish and our climate and our forests. And, nature will survive. There'll be new communities, new animals that will evolve to take the place of those that have been driven north or driven to extinction. I'm not that worried about nature over the long term. What I'm worried about is our human communities. Our economies will dramatically have to shift, and the relationships we have to the North Woods. Birch, for example. Birch matters deeply to lots of people. It matters profoundly to the tribes, but it also matters to lots of other people from different cultures. And birch is one of the species that's going to have the hardest time in a warming future in this area. Lake trout really matter to people here, whitefish. And right now, they're already changing their movement patterns. Whitefish, for example, do much better if they can spawn under ice. And we're seeing really rapidly diminishing ice cover overall. There's a really significant trend. It's dropped 79% on average in recent decades. And that means that human cultures have to change. It's getting more dangerous to go out ice fishing. We've had some really terrible accidents in the past 5 years where people thought it was safe to go out on ice that's always been safe, and then they fall through the ice. And if they don't have a survival suit, they don't make it. And those kind of shifts really matter to people. We are deeply tied to the places we live, and to have those change happen. To have those changes happen is something that we can make the decision that we don't want it to happen here, that we really value having a big, cold, deep lake, a set of forests, and some of the world's most extraordinary wildlife.
You mentioned before the abundant resource of fresh water that we sit on the shoreline of. And as years go on and fresh water becomes more of a valuable resource, and all eyes start looking at the Great Lakes basin, and especially Lake Superior. Again, there's so much. There's plenty for everybody. We end up getting put into a position where it's going to be a coveted resource that people want to take from this area and take from us.
Absolutely. And one of the more inspiring stories, I think, is that in 2010, the governors, the provincial leaders in Canada, the tribes, all the states came together and signed what's called a Great Lakes Compact to say no water can be taken out of the Great Lakes Basin except under very, very, very limited situations. Because people saw that with 22% of the world's fresh water, the world is going to want our water. There were proposals from a Chinese company to take tankers full of fresh water from Lake Superior and ship it to Asia. And that seemed like a really bad idea to a lot of people. It's not that you'd have to have so many boats you could never drain our lake and tanker ships, but just the very idea that somebody would profit off of selling our water, where would it end? And people saw the Aral Sea in Asia had been what was one of the world's largest seas, and just drop by drop, tiny little withdrawals for irrigation and then a warming climate, the Aral Sea has almost vanished. And you can go and see all these stranded fishing boats and ships just stranded on the shores of a really salty, horrible place now. It's impossible for people to make a living or survive. And that was because there was just Russia decided to drain a lot of the ocean for irrigation projects elsewhere. And bit by bit, people began to take the water, and nobody came up with an agreement to protect the lake itself. And it's a real ecological horror story. And in 2010, our community came together and said, there's some Democratic governors, some Republican governors, some Canadians, and yet we have to figure out that what we value is our water more than we're going to worry about our differences. And that compact will continue to protect the lake. No president, nobody can overturn it without the agreement of every single governor and premier and provincial leader in the region. So I think that's really key for protecting our Great Lakes water, and also a really great model for how we can come together across political differences now.
Dr. Nancy Langston's book is Sustaining Lake Superior on an Extraordinary Lake in a Changing World. These topics that we've covered are covered here in this book and a whole lot more as well. Lake Superior is as big of a topic as it is a lake. So, Nancy, I appreciate you coming on the program. I look forward to the next time talking to you.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.